You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 489.
Hello and welcome back to the Outdoor Station and a very special two-part interview with Jenny Wordsworth. Who, I hear you say? Well, you might know her better by her maiden name, Jenny Davis, the ultra-endurance athlete who hit the press headlines in January 2019 when she was medevaced from Antarctica, just a few weeks into her record-breaking attempt to be the fastest woman from the coast to reach the South Pole. A distance of some 715 miles in what turned out to be the most atrocious conditions ever experienced. In part one, we hear about the training, the planning, and costs of undertaking something like this, including the quote for probably the most expensive map in the world. If you visit the Outdoor Station and follow the links, you'll see that her endurance CV is somewhat extensive, with over 50 ultramarathons, including those in China, Iran, and Morocco. What is interesting is how her approach to this record attempt was influenced by her endurance running. Sadly, a bowel infection and peritonitis brought this attempt to a sudden close, and thankfully, as you'll hear, the medical support team made the right call just in time.
Yes, so last December, like you just said, I travelled over to Antarctica. And when I got there, I first actually climbed Mount Vinson, which is one of the seven summits in Antarctica, and that was kind of like an acclimatization trek. It's higher altitude down there than a lot of people realise because of the atmospheric pressure. Also, I really wanted to climb that mountain. I thought I'm only going to be in Antarctica once in my lifetime, so climbed that, and it's actually my honeymoon with my now husband, Matt. And then he flew back to the UK, and I started, I guess, the real reason I was there, which was an attempt to break the woman's speed record, to go from the coastline of Antarctica to the South Pole. So that is 750 miles, and the woman's record stood at 38 days. And the conditions of that record, if you like, is that it must be solo, obviously by yourself, unsupported, so no outside help whatsoever. So if you can imagine, you're dragging a sled behind you, you've got a harness on, you're pulling the sled, and in that sled must be absolutely everything you could need for the entire length of time it takes you to get to the pole. And then unassisted means you can't drive to the pole. I couldn't use a engine to get there. It's just me on my skis, human powered, all the way to the South Pole. So not using any kites, that kind of thing. And yeah, I started, I can't remember the exact date, but I think early December. And the conditions were incredibly difficult. And I say it was the worst weather they have on record since records began in Antarctica. So a lot of the days, I think I was hit with three storms overall, but minus 40 and winds of up to 70 knots would be quite normal when those storms were hitting. It was incredibly tough. So just to put it into context, Antarctica is the driest desert in the world. And precipitation levels are about 16 centimetres a year, which I remember finding out quite shocking when I found that out. Because you expect there to be a little bit more snow there, but there really isn't any. And I think in the first storm that hit was around 240 centimetres of snow. So it was really, you know, kind of once in a decade, 20-decade weather over there.
Can I just interrupt you there? The time of year that you were doing this, December, is the weather the same all year round, or was that supposed to be the better window of opportunity?
Yeah, so there's a very limited window that you're allowed to be in Antarctica to do anything, actually. So the season, if you like, for tourists. So if you're going there to visit penguins, or you fancy flying to the South Pole, climbing Vinson, whatever you're there to do, the season opens on the 1st of November and everything shuts down around mid to end January. And that is the Antarctic summer. So the weather is at its most stable and it's 24-hour sunlight. And then, you know, outside of that kind of season, it's 24-hour darkness and it gets incredibly cold. You're sort of going to minus 70, minus 80 degrees Celsius. So, yeah, that is the season to be doing this kind of thing. And, yeah, the weather was really unexpected. It was a heavy El Nino year last year. But I was assured by several weather experts that it wouldn't affect the weather in Antarctica. It's got its own six distinct weather systems and it wouldn't have an impact, but it absolutely did. And actually, there was two. It was a British guy and an American guy there at the time, also going for the men's record. And I think it was for both of them was their second attempts, and they actually stopped. I can't remember how many days in for each, but nearly 2 weeks ish. And because for them, I guess they'd seen what the conditions are normally like. And all of your equipment, if you think about it, is designed to kind of glide over pretty much frozen, compact ice, solid, and it's been whipped into all these crazy shapes from the wind over the winter season. And here we are with snow up to kind of thigh depth. So everything's sinking rather than gliding. And it was just very, very tough. And there was, I think that actually was a benefit to me because I had nothing to compare it to. I'd never been to Antarctica before. I definitely read a lot of books and spoke to a lot of people. And I did think it was a little bit odd that there was this much snow. But I just thought, man, Antarctica's hard. But yeah, it was really, really, really tough conditions.
Well, looking at your biography and some of the things you've done in the past, everything seemed to have involved considerably better weather. Marathon de Sable and the Iran Silk Road Ultra. Even Cape Wrath on a good day is obviously considerably warmer than doing Antarctica. So what drew you to? What drew you to the challenge?
It's a really good question. So probably about 2.5 years in the planning this expedition. And it actually started out as a group trip with a group of friends. We thought about climbing Vincent. I guess actually more of a mountaineer by background. And we thought it'd be brilliant to climb Mount Vincent together. And then from the base of Mount Vincent, ski to the South Pole. And so I said I would kind of lead this and do the planning and some very initial steps of finding out that was feasible. And then I found out that to get used to, you need data, you need satellite data imagery of the areas that you'll be crossing in Antarctica or passing over, because you need to know where the major crevasses are. So NASA have a satellite and you can pay to have imagery done of the route that you'll be traveling over, so you know that it'll be safe and where you need to avoid. And I had one conversation to find out how much that would cost, because the route that we were looking at doing had never been done before, so there's no pre-existing data that you could rely on, and it was over $500,000. So that idea came to a very swift end. And actually, I think just planning that, I mean, it was only about a week until I got the price, and then it was done. We weren't doing it. But that meant getting out all my old books that I read as a teenager on Shackleton and Scott, and I was just rereading everything. And yeah, I knew very quickly after that what I wanted to do down there, and got to work on it.
I know that when people go and do Everest as such, the price can mount up quite considerably with everything that you have to have in place before you can attempt it. What sort of, I mean, just as an aside, really, I'm just curious to know what sort of money it needs to be in place to attempt something like this. Apart from the equipment side of things, are there permits? Are there just the access to the area itself? The sort of safety and security, the first aid backup, just in case.
Yeah, so if you're doing something in Antarctica, like I did, which is a solo expedition, so you're completely alone on the ice, the British government actually need to sign you off to give you permission to go and do something like this. They need to know that you are you're going to keep yourself safe when you're out there. They don't want a bad press story either about something happening, so you need to be able to demonstrate a couple of things. And they actually outsource that permission giving, if you like, to a company called ALE, so Antarctica Logistics and Expeditions. And they also actually manage more the kind of tourism trips out to Antarctica. So anyone visiting the penguins or the South Pole, or you can ski the last degree as a group. In fact, you can ski the whole route from the coastline as a group with a guide if you have a lot of time off work. And so they actually decide whether you are ready, and they're happy to sign you off to go. And that's quite a lengthy process, or it can be depending on where you're starting from. But I did, I climbed Mount Denali. I think that was last summer. We didn't summit, unfortunately, because of the conditions, but spent a couple of weeks up the mountain. And then actually for me, it was my background in ultras and expeditions. And it's all about body management. And then also I did a lot of extra courses in self-rescue from a crevasse. That's one of the important things that you need to be able to demonstrate. And yeah, it's just time out in the field, time spent practicing the skill sets that you need out there. And I also went out to Norway for a couple of weeks with the then current world record holder to kind of learn from her as well, which was invaluable. But in terms of cost, therefore, it's going to be different from everyone, because it's a real commitment, of course, to getting the permissions you need to be allowed to go, and it can take a couple of years. And then there's the cost itself. So you've got to fly from the UK out to Chile, and then in Chile is where you probably spend about a week packing, repacking all of your kit and equipment, because obviously it all gets flown out there, but you have to fly it in its original packaging, and then you will repack it into something a bit lighter. And then from there, you fly to Antarctica. And you also have, from ALE, this company I mentioned, they also have to, when you're solo, they don't just, you know, say, I'll see you in 40 days at the South Pole. Every single evening, you have to satellite call base camp, let them know where you are, your coordinates, let them know you're safe, answer a few questions. I guess they're just checking that you're still with it. And so you kind of, and if there was anything that went wrong, they would come and pick you up in a Twin Otter, a kind of small plane. And so they are there as logistical support as well. So you're paying for that too. And again, those costs can be different for different expeditions.
So can you put a figure on it? I mean, if we're talking £500,000 for a map.
Yeah. I would say... like forget all the kind of background training and equipment and all of that, because I don't even know the final number for that. But just to go out to Antarctica, the flight itself, I think, is about 20 grand. Yeah, £20,000. And the logistical support costs on top of that probably go up to 100, 80 to 100, depends.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not a cheap weekend, obviously.
No, it's not a cheap weekend, yeah.
So coming back to the actual trip itself then, this snow that you were referring to, was it like that every day and you were able to sail over the top of it with the skis that you had or snowshoes? How did it actually physically work for you on a daily basis?
Yeah, so you're on skis and that is to manage crevasse risk. If you were on snowshoes, you would go through some of the crevasses, whereas skis, you glide over, and a lot of them you go over without even noticing that you're on a little crevasse. The beginning, the snow was manageable. The first kind of week is considerably uphill. It's uphill all the way to the pole, but the first week is probably one of the biggest inclines. And so there wasn't much snow settled there. But when the first two storms hit, I actually think I've blocked it out of my mind. but imagine, the only way I can describe it is sort of being inside a marshmallow. And you can't make out up or down. You can't see in front of you, and your compass has to sit on a chest mount, and so you cannot take your eyes off that compass or you will go the wrong way. And naturally the human eye is trying to look for up or down or just focus on something, and there isn't other than this compass. So, you know, 14 hours a day skiing, 12 to 14 hours, it changed every day. Your neck is cramping because it's a slight angle looking at this compass. A couple of times, and I've never had this before, I vomited from the nausea of just not having an up or down. And the snow on those first two storms was just horrific. I would take a couple of steps forward and I'd have to turn around and lift my sled up again because it had sunk so deep into the snow, and then take another two or three steps and repeat. And those were some of the hardest days because I was probably putting in physically about twice the effort to cover half the distance I was hoping to get that day. So it was really difficult. I remember as well, one of the days I got into my tent at night. I'd skied for 12 and a half hours, I think, and it was 70 knots of wind that day. And it was just unreal. Like it was just so bitterly cold, and the conditions were just so difficult. Got my tent up, fell into my tent, just absolutely exhausted, and did the nightly call to the logistics team. And you have to do that at the same time each evening. If they don't hear from you for 24 hours, they send out a plane to come and get you. So you can never miss that call. And I call them up, I give them my coordinates, and that also helps them figure out how far you've moved that day. And there was sort of stunned silence at the other end of the phone. And I was like, what's wrong? And they're like, oh, you moved today. I was like, what do you mean I moved? Like, yeah, I think I covered like 12 nautical miles, which was, you know, lower than I'd wanted. And they're like, oh, the other two gentlemen who were going for speed as well, yeah, they did the sensible thing today. They stayed in their tents all day, had a rest day. And I remember being so mad. I was like, what do you mean they stayed in a tent? Which is such a ridiculous reaction, but it's in that environment. And I was so annoyed that they hadn't gone outside and done what I'd done all day. And actually, one of the guys I'm really good friends with, Richard Parks, used to play rugby for Wales. And I messaged him on the Garmin InReach, which allows you to kind of send really short text messages. And I told them off. I was like, I cannot believe you didn't go outside today. And he's like, the conditions are awful, mate. Like, what are you talking about? That was a horrible day, I will admit. But yeah, I did go to bed that night feeling a little bit smug, I'll admit.
I'm not surprised. Yeah. Real women do it. Men just stay in bed. Yeah, okay.
Podcasts are based solely around self-powered travel. If you walk, run, cycle, paddle, climb, explore, or sail, we want to share your adventure, hear your highs and lows, and inspire others to go out and do more.
The thing is, I suppose it's all a strange illusion, isn't it? Because the pictures that we see of you and this expedition in Antarctica, it's flat. And, you know, you're looking like you're obviously pulling the, it's called a pulk, isn't it? It's not a sled, it's
yeah.
a pulk, yeah.
You can call it a sled.
Okay, yeah. So you're pulling this sled and everything looks like, oh, it's blowing a bit of a breeze, but it's then hard to visualise this complete marshmallow whiteout. And also the practical things in life that you have to do, such as, you know, eat, sort yourself out, feed yourself, not get frostbite, and obviously have a pee. That they're all day-to-day things that everybody still has to do. How did you manage to do that and not get yourself into a problem with any of those, really?
Yeah, so if you're pee, going to the bathroom is done very, very quickly.
I'm not surprised. Did you have a shiwi or something similar?
I did, yeah, I did have a shiwi. I'm a big fan of them. I think they're great. That worked really well. In terms of not getting frostbite, I mean, no one should be getting frostbite is the truth. And that is kind of a skill you learn. You need to be able to manage your core temperature. Hydration also plays a big part. I didn't have a mark on me. I did suffer from something called polithi, which is a condition a lot of women get in the cold. Men tend to get it on their abdomen, and it's to do where you tend to get it where you carry fat. So women carry more fat around their bums and hips and thighs, and men on the abdomen, and that tends to be more covered because you've got the big jacket over the abdomen area. But polithi, I actually think someone told me, and I haven't actually fact checked this, but that it's highly discovered cool sculpting, that form of liposuction. It's non-invasive, but they just freeze your fat and your body absorbs it. And so I got some free lipo when I was out there. It was really high winds, and it's just the winds hitting your legs. I wore a down skirt out there, which is crucial to kind of keep that at bay. But I did have one day where I didn't put it on, and I got polythied pretty badly. Yeah, that really burnt like hell. Really itchy overnight in the tent, and it kind of looks like a bad burn, and it heals. Remember, it healed perfectly well. I had some steroid cream to put on there from the doctors at Union Glacier, which is the base camp in Antarctica. Before I left, they gave me that because it's so common. But I did suffer from that, and that was really uncomfortable. But it probably went away about 4 or 5 days, and then it's so crucial. If you're doing this as part of a team, you have a buddy, so you bounce things off each other. So you're kind of like, if you remember to do this, what about that? But when you're solo, you've got to be able to do all of that by yourself. And the more fatigued you get, the more, you know, you can make mistakes. So for me, I had the routine, some of the real basics of the routine written inside the tent. And that was just to remind me the things you kind of have to do before bed. And it was, as soon as the tent was up, you are in the tent, you've lobbed in all your kit bags, like 4 or 5 of them. You have to get the stove on, number one, which you do inside your tent. There's a kind of like a little vestibule area, and there's a little part of the tent you can open for venting. And then the number one job is to melt a lot of snow as quickly as possible. And you're melting the water, all of the water that you need overnight. And for the next day. So I studied a lot of other expeditions, and I could see that the thing that they spent the most amount of time doing was melting ice to make their water. And they would do that 2 times a day, normally at nighttime before bed, and then in the morning to make their breakfast. And I came up with a system where I didn't want to do that. And when I got up in the morning, I wanted to get up and go. and not have to set up the stove again and prime it and, you know, melt some more ice. So I made some amendments to some modifications rather to a stove setup, and I find this guy in America who wrote a brilliant blog. I really wish I could remember his name, Ross somebody, and he came up with an amazing way to make these modifications to an MSR stove that really improved its efficiency. And that is brilliant because then you can bring less fuel per day, and that obviously feeds into the overall weight of your sled too. And it worked like a dream. So I saved probably a couple of hours each day just by doing that. And each night I would melt enough water to ski for the whole day the next day, enough water to make my hot meal that evening, and enough hot water in a flask to put inside my sleeping bag. It also acts as a hot water bottle. And then waking up in the morning, I would use the flask of water to make a coffee and breakfast, so I didn't have to have this back home.
Oh, I was wondering how you kept the water from freezing.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, it's really hot in the tent. on the days when the wind kind of calmed down, I was actually too warm some evenings. When the wind was really howling, outside the vestibule, things would freeze, but inside the actual tent with me, it was rather warm. I had a sleeping bag rated to minus 40.
The tent, I think, was a Hilleberg tent, wasn't it?
Yes, I love Hilleberg tents. I am banned from buying any more ever again because we have so many and they do last a lifetime. It was a brilliant tent. I had extra snow balances sewed on, so an extra 40 centimetre of skirt around the tent. And that is just because every evening, once you set up the tent, you need to bury snow all the way around, kind of building a mini snow wall. So it stays put for the evening with those high winds. The team at Hilleberg were great in getting all of that sewn on and the modifications needed.
Fantastic. So I know the expedition itself didn't actually complete as you hoped, but let's move forward to the point where you started to feel unwell. It must have been obviously a troubling time because you're talking to yourself as you're trying to achieve the task at hand. But how did you come to the conclusion that things were definitely not right?
Yeah, it was an interesting one. I knew deep down that I was ill. One of the things from being an ultra runner and doing these kind of sports and runs across deserts and whatever is you're very good at dealing with pain. Which sometimes actually is to your detriment because you'll run through injuries when you shouldn't be. But I definitely knew that this was something different. I was getting quite feverish in the evenings, and I just felt sick within myself, and I knew it was something probably not good. And I'll be honest, I'm not that proud of it, but I didn't want to tell immediately the doctors at base camp over the phone in the evening because I was worried that they would pull me immediately. There had been a British polar explorer, I think 2 years before me, he was quite sick with peritonitis. I think he got an infection of some sort. And when he called it in to let them know and they came to collect him, it was probably too late. He'd become septic and he passed away back in Chile when they got him out of there. So in that moment, I was really hoping that this was something that I could, you know, if it is an infection or it's a fever or whatever, it'll go away in a few days. But I didn't want to tell the team at base camp in case, you know, based on their horrific experiences just a few years ago and what everyone went through there and the loss of life, that they would just pull me immediately. So I told my dad, told Matt, my husband. Matt's a doctor, so we just kind of said keep an eye on it. And then it definitely got a lot worse. And so I thought, right, I'll tell the doctors this evening, and they kind of talked me through a couple of tests to see how I was feeling, what was my temperature, what was my heart rate. And it kind of deteriorated quite quickly from there. The next day I said I would take the day off and that maybe I just needed to rest. And I didn't move again after that. It was one rest day, and then the next rest day, I agreed reluctantly to a doctor to fly out and come and examine me in the field. And he said if I was well enough to continue, he would let me. Which I didn't believe at first. I thought they were trying to trick me. but that it sounds silly, but it's the mindset you're in when you're, it's kind of, we call it tent fever. This is the expedition of a lifetime. I wasn't about to give it up that easily. And so definitely challenged them a little bit on whether it was truly necessary for me to be medevaced. But the team are incredible. Like, they're used to dealing with people like that, so they know exactly what they're doing. Doctor came out and it was quite obvious that I was really unwell. My stomach was quite swollen. And I actually remember at this point, Richard Parkes, the British polar explorer I mentioned earlier, he had he'd stopped and he'd been in his tent, I don't know, 3 or 4 days by that point, just waiting for a plane to come back from the South Pole. So if you cut your expedition short, you don't get your own flight out of there if you're okay and you have food and you're fine. You have to wait until there's a tourist flight, if you like, coming back from the South Pole, which is kind of the same route back to base camp, and they'll land and pick you up. So I'd been chatting to him on the inReach, like I mentioned before, and I knew he was desperate to get home. His expedition had just come to an end too. He was miserable. And he's also really desperate to get home to his son, a 9-month-old Freddie. And so when the logistics team were trying to convince me I had to be medevaced, I said, I probably don't need it, but if you're coming out here anyway to kind of check on me, do you think once you've landed, you could just pop up in the air, fly for 5 minutes and pick up Richard, because he's about 60 miles in front of me and he's desperate to go home. And they laughed and told me to leave the logistics to them, please. but when they came to get me, and I was obviously sick, and I just burst into tears. The doctor was so lovely. I even remember as well, he did a pregnancy test just to rule everything out. And I said to him, if I find out I'm pregnant here right now, you're going to have a mess on your hands to deal with. You get quite upset. This is not the time or the place. So I had a good laugh about that. And then we took off in the air. I was really upset, obviously. And we flew for 5 minutes, landed and picked up Richard. And he had a massive smile on his face and was over the moon. And we were friends beforehand. But it was really amazing to have him there, because then actually we flew together back to base camp, and that's called Union Glacier. And that's the kind of hub in Antarctica. Whether you're climbing a mountain, you're there to go skydiving, anything you might be doing there. So it's fairly busy. And everyone who works there, they've been following my expedition every day, asking how I was getting on. And so they all came out to meet us off the flight. It was quite emotional. And yeah, from there, I had the day at Union Glacier. And it was really lovely for Richard and I actually to be together. And I've gone through the same thing together, but also to be around people. Everyone who works there does adventures and expeditions. And there's, you know, there's a joke that to work at ALE, you need to have at least 2 PhDs, even if you're just working in the kitchen. And they're an incredible, fascinating company. But they all understood, you know, what had happened out there. So it was kind of really comforting to be around people who got it. They understood what the conditions were like. Like a lot of the base camp had been destroyed in really bad storms. So they got it. And then suddenly that afternoon, I went downhill pretty quickly. I actually thought I was okay, it was getting better, and they suspected it was appendicitis, but they couldn't confirm that out there. And so the Aleutian jet, which is the big cargo plane, it's the only plane that can land on a blue ice runway. It's a really old looking plane, big Russian jet. It wasn't due to come for another 2 days, I think. And actually, when I got back to base camp, they thought, you know what, you can wait for that jet to come. You're kind of stable right now. But with the deterioration, they brought the jet forward. So I think it landed about 6 hours later. It was the soonest it could get there. And I was pretty out of it at this point. I don't remember too much. I remember Richard Parkes and a polar guide I became really close with, Rob Anderson. He was the first person to climb the Seven Summits solo. Real veteran, just an amazing person. They stayed with me the whole time. They sat and drank beers whilst I was in the medical tent hooked up to all these IVs. And they were amazing. Everyone was so lovely. And I flew back to Chile. Richard came with me on that flight and was admitted to hospital in Chile and arrived. Actually, it was all the same team of doctors who treated Henry Worsley, and he's the polar explorer I mentioned who passed away a few years ago there. And that was really sobering because I could see like the pain of what they'd been through before was still all over their faces, and they were so, they didn't know what they were going to find when I got off that flight. In the hospital, they finally diagnosed me that it was actually a bowel infection. And I had peritonitis, and the next step after that, I guess, is septicemia.
And that would have been fairly terminal, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's actually a lot of the, and then, sorry, I came back to London and was in hospital here at UCH and treated by a really specialist team here, but I recovered pretty quickly. And that is a lot of that, in fact, probably nearly all of that is down to the actions of the doctors in Antarctica. They pumped me full of so many antibiotics because they didn't really know what I had or what was going on, and that it made a huge difference. And, you know, it was 2 weeks or something, and I was, well, not fine, but, you know, I was medically okay again.
So it was a good call, really, from the medical team to have support system, obviously, up and running.
They learnt a huge amount, and it affected people so deeply when Henry passed away, that their systems now, I mean, they're just amazing. I was so impressed with how I was dealt with and ALE and how they were with me. So, yeah, they're amazing.
If you found this podcast as fascinating as I did, please make sure you tune in for part two, where we delve into the gear Jenny took, how her endurance experience influenced her choices, and how similar it is to the average everyday hiker and backpacker, except in minus 40 degrees. We also touch on the fabulous charity work she is devoted to, which involves getting more women into sport, and how she was key in getting the law changed in Iran just so women could run in a public race. Lots more fascinating stories to come next episode, and all the links can be found over on the Outdoor Station podcast show notes, as always. My thanks once again to Jenny, and until next time, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.